May be seated. Our next case is 2016-395, In Re C, CS, CLS, and the adoption by General Care. For the appellant, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, may it please the court. My name is Eric Smith, counsel for the amicus curiae in this case, Ohio Birth Parent Group. I'll be going for 5 minutes and then Mr. Hillman will take over and do the rebuttal and the rest of the time in the rebuttal. The issue in this case is not really one of the credibility of the mother, as the appellate court and the trial court tried to portray it. The mother's name is Carrie. The real issue in this case is whether the general care social worker, Kelly Shoemaker, and her supervisor did her job sufficiently and gave Carrie sufficient information so that her permanent surrender agreement would be knowingly and intelligently made.
Counsel, do you believe the standard is, I'm over here, do you believe the standard is at issue in this case? What that means in terms of whether a parent has exercised free will in giving up a child? Do we have the standard to consider today?
Of course, we have.
But do you think it's at issue? Is there some dispute about what the actual standard of law is?
We don't really have to dispute it, but the standard for duress fits in with the motion to dismiss under 41B2, and that's manifest weight of the evidence and contrary to law.
Here's my concern. I voted to take this case in because I thought the proposition of law looked like a very general standard that we needed to address. In looking at the briefs and in hearing your opening, it appears to me that this might be a very factual case. And it's really one about error correction. And so I'd like you to tell me why this case matters, not just to these parties, but to every other adoptive parent or every other parent who's considering giving up a child for adoption. Put it in more general terms for me, or I'm afraid you're headed for an improvidently allowed to get to the bottom line.
Okay. We essentially have two issues that fit into what were the steps that general care was supposed to take. That language is in the proposition. The facts of what happened here are not disputed. It's documented in the case notes and in general care's testimony, everything. What happened was Carrie was living with her domestic partner in the spirit of a common law marriage as a family unit with 5 other children. Her domestic partner was not the biological father. When Carrie was 3 weeks away from her due date, he said for the first time, "You can't bring the baby home. I can't deal with this. You can do what you want to do, but you cannot bring that baby home." She's a stay-at-home mother. She's not employed. Her kids have lived there for 6 years and considered Jeff is his name, domestic partner, a father figure, and they've lived as a family. That's not disputed at all. So the question really is that duress? We don't have to go into, was Carrie lying about all that? Or how much of that is true? It's really not disputed. Those actual facts are not disputed.
Is that a legal question as to whether that is or is not duress?
Yes,
we should respond to, or should we be guided by experts who can tell us the mental state and the rest of that? And is there any expert guidance in the record that we could look to confirm actual duress?
No, I don't think you need experts. I mean, in the other cases involving these, you know, this area, the courts have looked at what happened, and does that actually show clearly and convincingly that it was duress?
All right, your colleagues on the other side might suggest that there is ample evidence of an exercise of free will, signing documents, making oral statements, et cetera. How do you overlay your view that this is a duress situation with the hard evidence that it isn't duress?
Because it's not really just duress. Even if it's not duress, there's still the issue of, was Carrie counseled effectively? Did General Care follow the law and tell her about her options, and would she give her the information she needed to make her privilege?
Was she represented by counsel?
I'm sorry?
Was she represented by counsel?
No.
She was just dealing with the adoption agency, and her source of information was the social worker from General Care, correct?
That is correct.
Right. So, did she ever ask for an attorney?
I do not believe so, no.
Are you relying on any particular statutes that would govern what an agency is to do in a case like this?
Yes. Ohio Administrative Code 5101, 24209B1.
So, the facts that you've laid out in your brief are that her only contact was this brief meeting at Bob Evans' restaurant with the...
Before the permanent surrender, the administrative rule I just cited requires an in-person meeting with certain requirements.
Right.
One of those is to discuss options. They did meet in person. They met at Bob Evans. Otherwise, all their contact was phone and text messages. Maybe, I don't know if there was an email.
When you say they...
I'm sorry, the social worker who's responsible for the case.
And the biological mother, your client, had one in-person meeting at a Bob Evans restaurant.
That was the only in-person meeting they had, that is correct.
And how pregnant was she when she decided to give this child up for adoption?
She didn't decide it, she was forced to. But the answer is she did not feel forced to until Jeff told her 3 weeks, not weeks, 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 3 weeks.
So she counseled, allegedly, with the social worker for a mere 3 weeks before she gave this child, she surrendered the child.
She contacted General Care on March 15th. Her due date originally was April 7. The meeting at Bob Evans was March 27. This is 2014. At that meeting, Ms. Shoemaker went over paperwork, interviewed her about what's her family situation, and put it in her notes, all this stuff about Jeff and the kids in the 6 years. It's no mystery to what happened here. There's, ironically, not a single case note on that day or any other time about what options were discussed or what Carrie may have responded or decided about any options other than adoption and keeping the child.
Counsel, if I may, I'm over on the right side this time.
Sorry.
I'm going to follow Justice French, if I may, and try to get you to what I want to know about.
All right.
This case is tragic.
Yes.
But it's not what we're here for today. I presume, as the appellant, you want us, as the Supreme Court of Ohio, to not only correct this case, but to provide guidance to the world for the future.
Correct.
What went wrong here, from
General
the agency standpoint, that you contest, that you want corrected? Obviously, I'm going to give you a softball here. Everyone in this room will agree she was under duress. Done.
Okay.
What do we do from that?
You tell the people of Ohio and the adoption agencies of Ohio that the law must be followed. It's not lip service. I'm talking about the need to discuss options. That's the first.
Be more specific. What part of the law was not followed?
The part where the agency is required to discuss the options in lieu of surrender under the administrative rule. And
I thought they gave her a pamphlet and said, here's the law.
They did give her a pamphlet, and the pamphlet says, the social worker, quote, will give you complete information about services and options you may have. The assessor can tell you about parenting your child yourself, placing your child with a relative temporarily or permanently, placing your child with a friend or non-relative temporarily or permanently, guardianship and foster care options, state and federal laws.
Okay, so obviously there's a juncture. We're about 3 weeks out from a birth. There's two roads we can take. We can go for a permanent or a temporary.
That is correct, yes.
When and where and how can I find it in the record that that option was explained to this mother?
You cannot find it.
Let's talk about that then, please. I'm trying to use your time well.
I'm sorry?
I'm trying to use your time well.
Okay. There simply is no evidence that temporary custody was ever discussed. There's nothing in the case notes. There's nothing in general care's testimony was discussed. Carrie testified was never discussed. All they told her about was foster care. You gave more time by foster care, some vague thing about that. The only thing that exists is a sort of boilerplate, two-sentence thing in the written permanent surrender that says, you acknowledge that we went over this, that, and temporary custody and foster care options on March 27th. And then she signs the agreement, and that's basically what they're hanging their hat on.
Wait, where is the child now? And
counsel, would you please sit down?
He's supposed to take the first 5 minutes.
Counsel, would you please sit down?
I will. Thank you.
Where is the child now, and what's its legal status, and what's transpired from birth to now in terms of
my understanding
where the child has been and what its legal status has been along the way.
Okay. My understanding is that the original placement parents, the adoptive parents, got a placement when they found out that the mother was contesting it or trying to revoke it. They returned the child to general care, presumably to return to care. General care, as far as I understand it, put the child in a foster home. And then a month or so later, those foster parents, as I understand it, went on vacation, couldn't carry on and so they placed them in a third foster home with foster caregivers, I guess the phrase is, and that's where they are now. We have a stay on the adoption. There's no adoption order. My understanding is there may be, I don't know if there's an adoption petition or a
placement. Okay, counsel, thank you.
But it's in a home where the plan is for adoption by that foster parent.
That's my understanding.
By the foster parent.
That's my understanding.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Hillman.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'm Steve Hillman. I am the attorney for the appellant. There were some very interesting and germane questions asked. Why does this apply as standards to the general public? I think it has to be made clear to all adoptive agencies that you better follow the law. When it says discuss, it means sit down and discuss. It does not mean meet at a Bob Evans for a couple of minutes, hand him a bunch of papers, and you're done.
Counsel, are you referring to an administrative code when you say the law says, or are you referring to a statute?
Well, I'm referring basically to the administrative code that I believe is not instructionary, but it's mandatory, especially in an adoption, because what the legislature did was they gave a private agency basically the authority of a probate court. And when you do that, they had better follow the law precisely. They didn't do it. There was a question about, was there an expert? Yes, there was. Dr. Amato. I don't know why the trial court ignored him. I don't know why the appellate court ignored him. But there was an expert, and he said she should not be making any decisions. Now, the question, whether this person should have been able to relinquish rights is She had a fiduciary. She had a social worker that's supposed to look out after her. The social worker knew she had undergone major surgery. She was on medication, opiates, for pain.
Counsel, when you use the word fiduciary, that has a very specific legal meaning. What precedent do you have to support the notion that a social worker is a fiduciary in this kind of situation?
Not all social workers are fiduciaries, in this situation, she said, I am your social worker. The policy, supposedly the policy of, it is the policy, they testified to it, that this social worker is Carrie's social worker. She is not anything else. I'm here to help you.
But that doesn't make her a fiduciary from a legal perspective. So is there something that you can point us to? Is it only the agreement between the agency and the mother? Is that what creates a fiduciary relationship?
No, not the agency. I didn't say that. I said this particular social worker.
Well, I just mean the agreement. I'm just looking for any basis at all to say that the social worker is a fiduciary in this situation. From a legal perspective, she was acting in a fiduciary capacity.
Well, when she takes the position, when she puts herself, this social worker, Ms. Shoemaker, puts herself in the position that I am here to help you, then by her own actions, she is making herself a fiduciary. I've cited several cases which...
Counsel, let's look at the relationship here. She went to General Care. How did she find out about this agency? Did they approach her or she approached them?
I think she went online.
Okay. So once she contacted them, they said, we'll get everything put in place and we're going to send a social worker to talk with you, correct?
I don't know that they told her that.
How'd she get the social worker?
Pardon?
How did she make the acquaintance of the social worker?
That's the person who called her and said, I'm your social worker.
How did the social worker know about your client?
From General Care.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
She's an employee of General Care.
Thank you. Maybe I should ask that directly. So she's an employee of Gentle Care.
Right.
And she is designated or represented herself to be the social worker dedicated to your client.
Correct.
And so you question her ability to be impartial in giving advice, if no matter what the quality of the advice was, to this woman, your client.
No, I don't question her ability to give advice. She should have given it, is my point.
All right. So you're saying she wasn't motivated to give the advice? It was incomplete advice? She wasn't looking out for your client's best interest? What are you saying?
All of the above.
All right. Normally, in a private placement adoption, the biological mother will come into probate court and have a hearing held. And that hearing is before a magistrate, and they go through a litany of questions, take background information, and ascertain the motivation for the mother to place the child for adoption. None of that took place here, did it?
None of it. And I agree with you, that's exactly what a probate court does. None of that took place here.
Okay. And there was no encounter with the probate court by your client whatsoever.
Well, there was an initial filing in the probate court. My client appeared. They said, we don't have jurisdiction, basically. Go file
pre-adoption, pre-birth, pre-placement. There was no involvement with your client in the probate court?
None.
All right. The law does allow for the surrender to an agency, obviously a licensed agency in the state of Ohio. But the requirement that the placement be knowingly and voluntarily made without force or duress or reward is a requirement no matter whether the relinquishment takes place in front of a magistrate in probate court, a judge in probate court, or is done at the agency. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
If there are any other questions, I think my, is my time up?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Ebker?
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. May it please the court, John Ebker on behalf of Appellee Adoption by General Care.
Counsel, once the biological mother contacted your agency and said, I want to renege on my consent to adoption, it was under duress, the potential adopted parents, your clients, gave the child back, correct?
There's more, not necessarily, that's not accurate as to what exactly happened. After she signed the permanent surrender on the 4th, the next communication from her was around the 12th or 13th, and she indicated not that she wanted to change her mind or that she didn't understand anything. Her indication to the agency was that the biological father wanted to register and get involved. So AGC at that time did its due diligence, and there were two potential biological fathers. They had them both tested with DNA, and it was determined which one was the biological father. At that point, they had discussions with Mr. Lump, the biological father, and his attorney. And Mr. Lump stated to the agency in no uncertain terms, he wanted the child to be adopted, and he did not want the child to be, the permanent surrender to be undone. He did not want the child to be parented by Ms. Stearns.
But that's not his call.
What?
That wasn't his decision
to
make.
No, but that's the information that was, so after, and in responding to that, to your question, you know, I would respectfully submit that that events that occurred after the permanent surrender was signed is irrelevant to the issue of whether the permanent surrender was voluntarily signed
by Ms. Stearns. All right, but I'm asking the question, so answer it, please.
Yes.
What happened after tell me how your identified adoptive parents decided not to accept the placement of this child.
The adoptive parents?
Yes.
Yes. After, in this time period, the biological mother began contacting the adoptive family, and in the notes, it indicates they were scared, they felt that they were harassed, and they withdrew their intent to adopt because they were afraid based on the contacts from Ms. Stearns. She sent an email to them on Mother's Day, all the other items that were in the notes.
Okay, so you get the child back, correct?
Yes.
Why didn't you just give it back to the biological mother at that point?
At that point, once the permanent surrender was signed, and it's a valid, irrevocable permanent surrender, AGC was vested, they had legal custody of that child.
You could have undone that, though.
Absolutely, they could have. But as the agency, as the entity that was responsible for the best interests of this child, AGC had a responsibility and a duty to act in that child's best interest.
Did AGC get compensated for the placement for adoption?
Yes, when clients come to AGC to pursue adoption, yes, they do.
How much do they charge?
I think it's $30,000.
So they're looking for another 30.
That's not why they made the decision.
Did they give the 30 back to the first family that handed the child?
Yes. Yeah, they didn't make double recovery on this.
All right. But there's a profit motive involved here, is there not?
AGC is a nonprofit entity, but yes, there is money that's involved in this. But again, none of this was in the trial testimony. But I can tell you right now that AGC did not, their decision was not based on a monetary decision. Their interest was solely based on the best interests of their child and their professional judgment based on all the information they are receiving and the fact that there was a valid.
Well, and with the helpful guidance from the sperm donor who didn't donate anything else to the cause.
The biological father made his wishes known to AGC, and the biological father was called at trial, and he testified to those same intentions.
Was there, as part of her decision that she wanted to renege on her permanent surrender, was it represented that she was going to continue to live with the, I think you said his name was Jeff, the
Mr. Griffith, yes.
The father, not the father of the baby, but who she was living with.
Yes.
And he had changed his mind on having the child back in the home.
That was a representation that was made in one of the notes.
So, I mean, an alternative would have been, okay, we're going to, we're going to dissolve the permanent surrender. We're going to give the child back to the mother. And if you're concerned about the welfare of the mother, refer the matter to Children's Services so that they, the presumed experts on how a child fares in the home could have taken over. Yes. Was that option discussed or considered?
All the options were discussed by AGC. And
internally?
Internally, yes. Yes, all their options
why
were...
Why wouldn't that have been a solution?
Again, they executed their professional judgment. They're certified adoption assessors. They've done this for 30 years. And in their view, and it wasn't just information from the father, while this was going on, Ms. Stearns went on her social media and television campaign and making false accusations and accusations about AGC. Unsolicited, AGC started getting more and more information that frankly was very negative, and it's in the notes, about Ms. Stearns. So they're responsible for this child. They have legal custody of this child, and they're getting all this information, and they executed their judgment. And again, it was a valid permit.
Well, let's go back to the duress then question, because that's pretty much the crux of it. Was she under duress when she negotiated the permanent surrender? And she says, and I guess there's corroborating evidence, that she was under duress given the situation at home, that she was told that she would not be able to bring that child back to the home she shared.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because difficult circumstances, pressures, whatever's going on in someone's life, it doesn't automatically equate to duress. The legal concept of duress in Ohio that's been that way since Talmadge in the 1950s and through all the adoption cases, difficult circumstances, pressure, is not the same as duress.
What's your definition of duress?
When someone is unable to execute their own free will. And the trial court determined applying
Let's think about that for a minute. She's living with this gentleman, five children,
yes.
Who consider him to be a father figure.
Yes.
Is there any indication the Children's Services Board was ever called in to this home because he was abusive or the conditions were below par?
No.
For in that home for the five children of hers, they were all her children,
right? They were all her children, correct.
So she's living with them. Presumably she loves the man or has some affection for him. Her children have affection for him, and he says, I don't want that baby to come home. What would you call that if it's not duress?
It's again, with any unwanted pregnancy, unplanned pregnancy that someone is considering surrendering, as the agency director testified and as the amicus stated in their brief, most if not all face difficult, very hard decisions. But it's not duress. She still had a choice. She may not have liked the choice, but she had a choice. And she chose to contact AGC. She chose to execute that permanent surrender.
Counselor, I want to follow that up, if I may.
Sure.
I don't think there's any question that she was under duress. I think you're kind of trying to thin it out so it doesn't look like it affected the decision. If you're told by your live-in that you and your five children are going to be out on the street if you bring the sixth child here, I'm going to ask you just to accept for a moment that's duress. Okay? What legal standard does the Supreme Court of Ohio have at this point when someone is under duress to ensure that, boy, all their options have been explained to them carefully by a social worker, including the 30-day option, which clearly was not explained here?
Well, again, it still comes down to duress and whether someone has a choice.
Asking you, accept my duress argument for a second.
Okay.
If you're under duress, what duty does a social worker have to demonstrate to the world, including these seven people, that the options were explained pursuant to the administrative code?
Well, as a point of clarification, the administrative code just describes that all the options including temporary placement, have to be discussed. There's no specific requirement of a number of 30 or 60 days to be explained. So what evidence do we have in this case? She signed the Ohio Laws and Materials said the adoption process was explained to her. When she signed the permanent surrender says there was discussion and counseling on all options, including temporary custody. That's in the documents she signed.
When and where did that take place?
At the permanent surrender. She signed the permanent surrender, had that language in it.
Where did that take place?
Is that at the Bob Evans restaurant?
No. The Bob Evans restaurant was the meeting, the one-on-one, and it wasn't a brief meeting. It was an hour meeting.
Try to answer the question. When and where did that document get signed?
April 4th at the permanent surrender at Mr. Griffith's house.
Who was present?
Ms. Stearns, a social worker from AGC, and another social worker witness.
And how long did that meeting take?
Long enough to go through the documents, and there was a question and answer colloquy to explain and memorialize the voluntariness of Ms. Stearns' intent.
And that was recorded?
That was recorded, and it's not required by law. But AGC decided for just this purpose to record a question and answer.
So that goes to the voluntariness or the duress issue. Can you clarify the answer to Justice Pfeiffer's question as to the location of the child and the pendency of adoption proceedings at the moment?
Sure. So after the first adoptive family withdrew their consent, I think it's over 2 years. I think it was the summer of 2014, maybe June, the child was placed with a prospective adoptive couple, family. That family is in line to adopt the child. He's been in the same home for 2 years, and if the permanent surrender is upheld, that is the family that the adoption proceedings will proceed upon.
And is there a case pending in the probate court?
They've notified them that they go
Who's
through.
They?
The agency files a document with the probate court. It's all being held in abeyance, and we've all agreed to hold that.
Is there a case pending in the Franklin County probate court?
Yes. Okay. And it's held in abeyance while this.
There's a petition for adoption.
Yes.
That's been filed in the name of the people who now have this child.
I believe so. I believe it has been filed. But
wait. You said yes to two questions from my colleagues that it had been, and now you're going, I believe it's been filed. Which is it? Do you know? If you don't know, it's okay to say, I don't know.
But no, to be clear, there's documents have been
filed. Well, I'm not clear.
I don't know. I don't know if it was
well,
if
now,
it's a formal
there
petition.
There we have it. All right. You don't know.
Yeah. Well, you don't know if it's a formal petition. But you know that there are adoptive parents who want to adopt this child,
yes.
And that's where the child has been for the last 2 years.
2 years, correct.
Can you go back to you were starting to list out the testimony that related to whether the different options were explained to her, and specifically the temporary placement. Talk about what evidence we have in the record that it was explained to her. You said that she signed at the permanent surrender. She signed the document. But what else? I mean, what testimony where somebody said, yes, I heard it, or yes, I said it?
Sure. Ms. Shoemaker, the social worker who was at the meeting with her on March 27th, testified that she went over all the materials. She went over temporary surrender. She went over Exhibit M, which is the pamphlet that describes temporary surrender. Ms. Shoemaker said they went through each document thoroughly. She found
Where is that testimony?
It's on July 31st, 176. Ms. Shoemaker talks about the meeting.
I understand, but where did she give that testimony?
At the trial in this case.
Oh, in the trial, okay.
Yes, at the trial in this case.
I'm looking at that testimony, and I see that she does say that she went through the pamphlet, and she went through it carefully from start to finish. What I don't see is the language that I think you just used, which was, yes, I talked about temporary placement with her.
Well, and most importantly, the the question and answer that was recorded on the day of the permanent surrender, that recording was played for the trial judge. And in that question and answer, Ms. Stearns asked, were you asked, given the option for a temporary custody, and do you decline that option? She said yes. So she acknowledged she was aware that temporary custody, that she could have asked for more time. She acknowledged her own words, which were played for the trial judge. She acknowledged that she was informed about that option.
There was some allegation, I think, by Mr. Hillman, that his client was had a difficult delivering, was on medication at the time of April 4th.
She had a C-section delivery, and there were the medications that were attendant to having a C-section.
Which were?
Pain medication.
Which was?
I don't recall the exact.
Was it an opioid?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And
under those circumstances, your agency would still take a relinquishment from a mother who's on painkillers.
When they took her test, when they took her surrender, she was asked, "Are you under the influence of anything that would influence your, that would affect your able to make a voluntary decision?" She said no. The two social workers that were there, Ms. Shoemaker testified there was nothing about her on that day that indicated that her ability to make a decision was compromised. And it's consistent with what she had been telling them throughout the process, that her intention was to surrender. After the birth, she told them, "I'm even more unsure of my decision." Her trusted aunt said she's at peace with her decision. The independent social worker at the hospital said, now that she's had the baby, she's more sure of her decision. All the information they were given leading up to the surrender was that Ms. Stern's intention was to voluntarily surrender her child. And everything that took place in the question and answer on the day of the surrender confirmed that understanding.
But she was. Your agency talked to all these people before April 4th. Is that correct?
In between the birth and the surrender, the agency was in contact with Ms. Stearns, her aunt, and the hospital social worker, and all those parties indicated that Ms. Stearns' intent, she was confident in her decision, was to surrender this child.
But her motivation for surrendering the child was the fact that she couldn't come home with the baby.
That's where her testimony was. The trial court, after hearing her testimony, he heard her testimony for a day and a half. He found her to be disingenuous, and he found her claims of duress were feigned. And opposing counsel may disagree. This court may disagree with that viewpoint. But the fact is, there was competent, credible evidence to support the trial judge's determination that she was disingenuous and that her claims of duress were feigned.
And counsel, do you think the trial court made a factual finding that she was informed about temporary placement?
Absolutely. He made the finding, and it was affirmed on appeal. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
In answer to most of the questions, I refer the court to Exhibit K in my brief, where I go down it and explain, I don't know, 19 or 20 different places. First, April 12th, it'll show that she called and said that she no longer wanted to relinquish her child. It had nothing to do with Mr. Lump. They said that on Mother's Day, the adoptive family got some sort of a message. Please, court, note, on April the 30th, they went up to the adoptive family and moved the child to a foster home. Now, I can't give you the exact date of Mother's Day, but it's the first Sunday, I believe, in May. So it was not that thing that caused the adoptive parents what they said was, return the child. When a mother wants a child, we don't want to adopt. I don't know whether the $30,000 paid by the first adoptive family was returned or not. All the information given is it's non-refundable.
Did the agency pay the maternity costs for your client?
No. She had her own insurance. She received no money. She received no compensation. There was a question about best interest, but you can read the whole transcript. You will not find one statement about Camden, best interest or not. You will not find anything because it isn't there. There's no evidence that all the options were explained. In fact, the trial court says you didn't discuss them, but she's smart enough that she should have known what they were.
Well, that's not quite fair, counsel.
Well, I'm being kind of disingenuous, but that's in one spot.
I don't think you want to be disingenuous in here. In looking at the transcript, I will give you that it's not as direct as I would like it to be. But in looking at the trial court's conclusion, don't we have to assume that there was a factual finding made that all of the options were explained to her?
No, I'm sorry, I have to disagree. When I read the findings of the trial court, they said that it wasn't discussed. They define what discussion is, to sit down and talk it over. And then they say that wasn't done. Then in another place, they say it was done. I don't think they know, to be candid. Temporary placement is never discussed. The 30-day, never discussed. And the answer is they knew about Dr. Amato. They knew about the C-section. And she was on Vicodin, according to the testimony of Dr. Amato. His testimony also says because Vicodin has, I can't ever tell the difference, oxycodone or oxycontin. I think it's oxycodone in it, plus Tylenol, that it accentuates or modifies the effect of the opiate. And I don't know if there's a case pending, something seriously wrong in the probate court, because there have been restraining orders stopping that, including this court's, and that no, the status quo of whatever. And the 2 years with the foster home, I don't know that they're an adoptive family or not, but that's the fault of GentleCare. Why didn't they just give the child back?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.